extra space. It's not that safety devices like seatbelts and child safety seats weren't around. They were. But without laws mandating their use, their presence amounted to little more than suggestions. It was, after all, a remarkably less restrictive era. This was as true of the art, fashion, and music of the time as it was for laws pertaining to automobile passenger safety. Generally speaking, there weren't any. This, of course, was just fine by most of us, at least until the moment we found ourselves screeching into the rear end of a line of cars unexpectedly stopped on the highway. Like most other kids of the time, I took full advantage of the liberties afforded me. On a road trip, I wandered about the rear seat compartment of our car in the same way a cruise passenger might rove around a ship. I might begin my day by taking in some sun up top on the rear window ledge, lying flat on my back and staring up at the sky through the grid of radio antenna lines embedded in the glass. When lunchtime rolled around, I'd join my fellow passengers slash brothers in the lavishly appointed dining area that was the back seat. After finishing my meal, I'd grab a pillow and retire below decks to the floorboard, where I stretched out for a nap on the warm and comfy shag carpet, positioning my belly just so over the hump of the transmission housing. After waking, I might check in with the captain on the bridge for an update on progress toward our next port of call. Really, all our car lacked was a shuffleboard deck and poolside bar. At the time, the idea of wearing seatbelts, especially in the back seat, seemed borderline crazy. Why would anyone wear seatbelts in the back seat? If Dad has to stop suddenly, we have seats right in front of us to prevent us from flying forward. Isn't that why car makers pad the back of front seats anyway? In fact, the first thing my brothers and I did when we climbed in the back seat before a long road trip was tuck the seatbelt buckles and latches into the crevices where their sharp edges wouldn't pose a threat to our tender rears. My mother reluctantly turned a blind eye to our buckle burying. As a physical therapist who worked in a hospital, she saw firsthand the victims of car crashes and understood the tragic consequences of passengers being tossed around cars. But she also knew that if she insisted we buckle up, our griping would be intolerable. "But nobody else's mom makes them buckle up in back," we'd have whined. And we would have been right. Almost no one did wear seatbelts at the time, especially not in the back seat. My mom, however, always made certain to buckle herself in and insisted anyone else sitting in the front seat did as well. After all, there were no cushiony seatbacks to protect those in front in the event of an accident, only a hard dashboard and windshield. My dad grudgingly complied, more out of a sense of duty as our father and protector than concern for his personal safety. He reasoned that if an accident sent our car into a wild spin, wearing a seatbelt would hold him in place in the driver's seat so he could deftly steer us all away from further peril. But we all knew that when he was in his car alone, he rarely buckled up. It wasn't that Dad disregarded safety entirely when it came to our cars. If you asked him, he'd say that safety was a primary reason for buying the cars he did. The way he saw it, size was the best safety feature. Bigger cars, he said, were safer cars. In his mind, there was no better way to protect his family on the road than by surrounding us in an impregnable fortress of steel, an apt description of every car he ever bought. He was right to a certain extent. Crash tests at the time showed, and still do today, that large cars fare significantly better than smaller cars in collisions, particularly when the two smash into each other. In general, the old joke that the bigger car always wins holds true. However, what my dad and most other car buyers of the time didn't realize was that while bigger cars fare better, unrestrained passengers inside them often don't. The real threat to those inside isn't the first collision, when car hits car, but the so-called second collision, when occupants hit the steering wheel, dashboard, windows, or even other occupants. It was a concept researchers had understood for decades, but few people outside the crash test labs were in a rush to do much about. It was no accident, pardon the pun, that automobile travel in the 70s wasn't safe. The truth is, automakers and auto buyers had informally colluded for years to prevent safer vehicles and smarter driving practices. Locked in an ongoing battle to woo buyers, car companies resisted adding safety features to their vehicles if it meant making them more expensive. For their part, many consumers were just as reluctant to buy cars with safety features because they believed their presence meant the cars must be somehow unsafe. As an example, take the package of safety features known as Lifeguard, which Ford introduced and aggressively marketed in 1956. Lifeguard was the culmination of years of crash research conducted at Cornell University and Ford's own test labs. The idea was championed by Robert McNamara, president of the Ford division and one of 10 intrepid young whiz kids Henry Ford II recruited to turn around his foundering car company. Launched with great fanfare, Ford's ads for Lifeguard detailed the safety package's many innovations. The Lifeguard steering wheel, its deep center structure acts as a cushion in the event of an accident. Double grip door locks, designed to give extra protection from doors springing open under shock. Safety belts, provide new protection and peace of mind, plus other innovations, such as a cushioned instrument panel, padded seat backs, and swing-away rearview mirrors. These pioneering advancements helped Ford earn Motor Trend's Car of the Year award for 1956. There was just one problem. Hardly anyone bought the optional Lifeguard package. After an initial flurry of interest, sales quickly tailed off, as did sales of Ford's. Meanwhile, Chevrolet was breaking all-time sales records by pushing cars with bigger, more powerful V8 engines. In 1955, the year before Lifeguard's debut, Chevy outsold Ford by 67,000 cars. The year after Ford spent millions promoting Lifeguard, Chevy tripled that number. A seething Henry Ford II muttered, "McNamara is selling safety, but Chevrolet is selling cars." The spectacular flop of Lifeguard gave birth to an auto industry mantra: safety doesn't sell. The failure confirmed what many auto executives already suspected. People want to believe they're immune to tragedy. They want to believe car accidents are rare events, and automobiles are places where they can enjoy themselves in carefree safety. The last thing car executives wanted to do was dispel those notions. So even as automakers occasionally introduced new safety features, crash-proof door locks and padded dashboards, among others, such improvements were offered as options rather than standard equipment. Automakers also refrained from promoting the devices. When they did, the advertising portrayed them as helpful conveniences. Safety locks weren't designed to keep doors closed and occupants inside the vehicle in a crash. They helped parents prevent curious kids from unlocking doors when cars were in motion. Power brakes weren't intended to help drivers avoid slamming into a stopped garbage truck. They made it easier to come to a smooth halt at a traffic light. But car companies went a step further. For much of the first 7 decades of the industry's existence, automakers actively lobbied against any safety requirements that would add to their production costs or cause buyers to think twice about automobile safety. By the time devices such as automatic seatbelts and airbags became widely available in the 60s and 70s, American car makers simply fought them out of habit as much as anything else. Depending on how you define the term, seatbelts were around long before the automobile. Edward J. Claghorn first patented such a device in 1885, but his safety belt was designed for people who performed tasks at perilous heights, such as firemen, sailors, telegraph linemen, and, intriguingly, according to Claghorn's patent application, tourists. Wearers strapped the belt around their midsection like a typical waist belt, then used a pair of carabiner-like hooks to secure themselves to a fixed object, a telegraph pole, a ship's mast, or, presumably, for tourists planning on tipping back a few Mai Tais in the Tiki Lounge, a high bar railing. The first true automobile seatbelts appeared around the turn of the century. Most were installed by automobile owners, not to prevent injury in the event of an accident, but simply to keep from being flung from their seats when encountering a bump or rounding a corner too quickly. Seatbelts caught on particularly with auto enthusiasts who raced their machines. Still, few automobile owners went to the trouble or expense of installing them on their own. Some even argued that seatbelts were dangerous. In truth, there was evidence to back up the claim. In some types of collisions, lap belts, the only kind of seatbelts then in use, were found to cause even more serious injuries. What was really needed was a new type of seatbelt. Hugh DeHaven was well acquainted with the subject of automobile safety, having survived a deadly crash himself. While training to become a pilot during World War I, another flyer practicing gunnery runs clipped the wing of his aircraft, sending both planes plummeting to the ground. The other pilot died, but DeHaven survived. In fact, the worst injuries DeHaven suffered, ruptures to his pancreas, liver, and gallbladder, were the result of an unfortunately pointed buckle on his safety belt that tore into his abdomen. DeHaven struggled with the mystery of why the fates of two men involved in such similar crashes could have turned out so differently. He would devote a good portion of his life looking for the answer. Following the war, DeHaven applied his training as a mechanical engineer toward becoming a freelance inventor. Many of his most successful ideas involved improvements in packaging, finding new ways to ship fragile goods with minimal damage. DeHaven's innovations were successful enough that he was able to retire in 1933 at the advanced age of 38. But fate would have other plans. 2 years later, he witnessed a horrific high-speed crash that left a driver horribly injured. When his face slammed onto the sharp steel protrusions of his dashboard. Shaken by the experience and recalling his own accident, DeHaven wondered, if fragile goods can be packaged for safer transportation, why can't people? DeHaven had neither the facilities nor medical background for such research, but he did have a sharp mind and a carton of eggs. Using his kitchen as a lab, DeHaven began dropping eggs from increasing heights onto a scrap of half-inch foam. None of the eggs broke. Eventually, DeHaven reached the ceiling, 10 feet above the spongy mat. Still, the eggs he dropped remained intact. In 1947, DeHaven repeated his egg-dropping experiment for a group gathered outside the Cornell University Medical College. On this occasion, he dropped eggs from a height of 100 feet onto a rubber mat just 3 inches thick. From such a height, the eggs attained speeds greater than 50 miles per hour. Many bounced off the mat and sprang as high as 30 feet in the air before being caught by onlookers. Yet not a single egg was scrambled. For DeHaven, it was promising evidence that even delicate objects could withstand high-velocity impacts, provided there was a modest amount of cushioning. However, eggs weren't human bodies. To gather more evidence, DeHaven collected newspaper clippings of what he called miraculous survivals. One account described a sailor who was blown off a cliff by a mighty gust of wind and fell 320 feet onto a sandy beach below. Much to the amazement of several eyewitnesses, the man got up and walked away. And the New York Times detailed a young woman's attempt to commit suicide by jumping from her 9th-floor window at Detroit's Palmetto Hotel. Instead of plummeting onto hard pavement, she landed on a freshly tilled flower bed. When onlookers rushed to the spot, they were astounded to find the woman conscious and talking. DeHaven published his research, concluding that the human body could withstand tremendous impacts as long as the force of the blow was distributed over a large area of the body. In other words, it wasn't the fall or collision that killed people, but how and on what they landed. Combined with his ideas on packaging occupants in vehicles for safe transportation, DeHaven's findings would guide future crash survival investigations, and DeHaven himself would become known as the father of crash survivability. From his base at Cornell University, DeHaven launched an investigative effort, the Crash Injury Research Project, CIR, in 1942. As part of his research, he conducted the first practical crash tests, which initially focused on aircraft safety. After creating the first crash test dummies, he strapped his sensor-equipped mannequins into simulated cockpits and repeatedly sent them hurtling down the rails of a long descending ramp to a jolting halt. Each time, he measured the forces exerted on the dummies and filmed their movements using special high-speed cameras. Analyzing the data, he reached two conclusions. First, aircraft interiors can be de-lethalized through better design, particularly by eliminating protrusions and hard surfaces. Second, the severity of injuries significantly increases when occupants aren't wearing safety belts. Although DeHaven acknowledged that in some types of crashes, seatbelts can exacerbate injuries, such as the injuries he'd himself sustained in his airplane crash years earlier, he concluded the problem wasn't the seatbelts themselves, but how they were designed. He began contemplating improvements. Working with an engineer named Roger W. Griswold, DeHaven made a critical modification to the standard lap belt design. He added an extra strap that crossed the wearer's torso diagonally from shoulder to waist. This strap was designed to restrain the upper body and head in a collision, distributing the force of an abrupt stop over a greater area of the body, and minimizing the devastating hinge effect caused by a belt solely worn across the lap. Griswold and DeHaven patented the design, called the CIR Griswold Restraint in 1951. It was the world's first three-point safety belt, a device that would ultimately be hailed as one of the most important patents of the 20th century. Unfortunately, DeHaven and Griswold have never received anywhere near the recognition they deserve for the idea. Posterity would bestow the lion's share of the credit for development of the three-point safety belt to Niels Bohlin, a Swedish mechanical engineer employed first by Saab and later by Volvo. Bohlin's first modification was to change where, and to what, the belt straps attached. Previous designs attached the top of the shoulder strap to the backs of seats. The problem with this design, as proven in crash tests, was that the seat backs themselves were often unable to withstand the force of a head-on impact. The seat backs broke, and the occupants, still strapped to their seats, were hurled forward into the dashboard, to their considerable dismay. Bohlin's design attached the top of the belt to the car frame, providing a solid anchor. Next, Bohlin repositioned the buckle. Whereas the CIR Griswold design kept the buckle in the middle of the lap, Bohlin moved it beside the opposite hip. This new position ensured that the lower section of belt was always pulled taut across the wearer's lap, essential for safe use, and also allowed the user to buckle up with a simple motion using one hand. Bohlin's revolutionary three-point seatbelt design was widely hailed, at least in Europe. After Volvo made the new belt standard for its cars sold in Sweden in 1959, the company eventually took the unusual and admirably benevolent step of making Bohlin's patented three-point seatbelt design freely available to all other car manufacturers. By 1965, all cars manufactured in Europe were required to include front seatbelts. Though Niels Bohlin would never become as internationally recognized as Sweden's other noteworthy contribution to humanity, I'm speaking, of course, of the legendary pop group ABBA, he would be revered in engineering and auto industry circles. Credited as the man who saved a million lives, Bohlin was inducted into both the Automotive Hall of Fame and National Inventors Hall of Fame, taking his place among Orville and Wilbur Wright and Thomas Edison, among many others. Bohlin's three-point seatbelt that was enthusiastically hailed in Europe got a cooler reception across the pond. Following the failure of Ford's lifeguard package, U.S. automakers were understandably reluctant to add any features to cars designed explicitly for occupant safety. And despite the mounting number of roadway fatalities, American car buyers remained apathetic about protecting themselves and their families. If efforts to improve automobile safety were going to gain momentum, they'd need a benevolent sponsor, a party with a vested interest in making the road safer and with deep pockets to support the cause. That advocate was the automobile insurance industry. As a growing number of cars jamming American roads spurred a corresponding rise in collisions and insurance claims, automobile insurance companies concluded it might be cheaper to spend money on finding ways to prevent accidents or at least minimize the injuries that resulted from collisions. Executives at one of the leading insurance companies, Liberty Mutual, became aware of the work being conducted at Cornell University, home to Hugh DeHaven's CIR project. After meeting with researchers, Liberty Mutual agreed to underwrite their efforts to advance vehicle safety. But company executives had one additional request. They wanted Cornell engineers to showcase new safety innovations in a way that would spark the interest of skeptical car buyers. The result was one of the most simultaneously insane and delightfully daffy vehicles in automobile history. Dubbed the Survival Car, officially the Cornell Liberty Mutual Survival Car, this marvel was first unveiled to the public in 1956. From the outside, the car didn't look much different from a typical sedan. But the audacious interior looked like something straight out of Forbidden Planet, or one of the many other sci-fi movies of the era. The driver's seat was moved from the left side to the middle of the car to reduce the chance of injury from side impacts. The driver sat in a U-shaped, contoured capsule seat mounted firmly to the floor. To eliminate the risk of the driver's face being smashed into the steering wheel or chest being impaled on a rigid steering column, these components were removed. Instead, the driver steered using two hydraulic levers jutting out from a padded console like the handlebars of a bicycle. An enormous wraparound windshield, which afforded the driver a sweeping panoramic view, was kept spotless by five wipers. One passenger sat in a rear-facing seat behind the driver, while another was positioned to his rear left. Two more could be securely strapped into form-fitting rear seats. A roll bar provided protection overhead, while two pairs of folding double doors, like those used in telephone booths, kept occupants safely inside the vehicle in a crash. The survival car was impressively innovative, meticulously engineered, and of course wildly impractical, but it drew crowds and sparked publicity at the same auto shows where American automakers spent huge sums introducing their latest models. The survival car still appears alongside some of history's most stylish and beloved automobiles at the Henry Ford Auto Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. By pointing out every stylish but lethal flaw in the design of their newest cars parked just steps away, the makers of the survival car drove many auto executives to the brink. To demonstrate that existing car models could in fact be practically modified to improve safety at minimal cost, Cornell engineers produced a second survival car in 1960. To create this version, the team took a base model Chevrolet Bel Air and retrofitted it with many of their most practical and inexpensive safety ideas. Pointy levers and controls were replaced with rubber knobs and recessed buttons, and the dashboard was padded. Seats were outfitted with three-point belts, and mesh whiplash nets were added to cradle the heads of front seat occupants in the event of a rear-end collision. Finally, the entire perimeter of the car was wrapped in a ring of thick protective rubber. Basically, the Cornell team turned the Bel Air into a bumper car. The survival cars didn't stick around long, but the cause they championed did. The intriguing cars proved instrumental in generating public awareness of vehicle safety and helped win valuable allies for the automobile safety movement. As public opinion swayed in favor of safety improvements, lawmakers also backed the effort. In 1961, Wisconsin became the first state to require the installation of seatbelts in the front seats of passenger vehicles. Soon, other states followed suit. When the federal government began contemplating stricter measures, automakers raised the white flag and began making voluntary changes. They announced that lap seatbelts, not Niels Bohlen's superior three-point belts, would be installed in the front seats of all cars produced in 1964 and added to rear seats by 1966. But the Big Three were about to get broadsided from a new direction. In 1965, Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed was published. Remembered today as the book about the Chevy Corvair, the exposé included just one chapter about the car and its alleged unsafe handling design. Ironically, while Nader's concerns about automakers emphasizing style over safety proved valid, his harsh criticism of the Corvair may have been a bit overstated. Assessing claims made in the book, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, testers showed the 1960-63 Corvair does not result in abnormal potential for loss of control or rollover, and is at least as good as the performance of some contemporary vehicles. The book's main focus was the auto industry's callous resistance to incorporating sensible safety measures in cars due to cost. Nader further charged that marketing ideas, rather than engineering principles, were given higher priority in how automobiles were designed. As evidence, he pointed to attractive but highly reflective chrome instrument panels that blinded drivers in bright sunlight, and bumpers shaped like sled runners that forced pedestrians under a car's front wheels when struck. Nader concluded that only the government had the power to compel automakers to incorporate safer design concepts and install devices already proven to prevent deaths and injuries. The book's sales took off like a 66 Corvette Stingray. Not surprisingly, Nader's fans didn't include General Motors executives. In fact, the company took extreme steps to silence and intimidate the author. In a later lawsuit, Nader accused GM executives of tapping his phone, interrogating acquaintances, and hiring call girls to solicit him for sex. And he won his case. GM President James Roche was forced to personally apologize to Nader before Congress for the company's actions. The firestorm the book created, combined with mounting complaints from the public and insurance industry, led to a series of widely publicized congressional hearings on road and vehicle safety in 1966. The result was that the government did exactly as Nader advocated. It gave itself the ability to establish and enforce national safety standards for highways and automobiles. The Highway Safety Act gave the federal government the power to set strict standards for highway construction, including better lighting, guardrails, and barriers between opposing lanes of traffic. The National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act created the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, the agency that would set and enforce vehicle design standards. The NHTSA quickly mandated the installation of seatbelts, including three-point belts in the front two outboard seats, headrests, energy-absorbing steering wheels, shatter-resistant windshields, windshield wipers, standardized bumper heights, recessed control buttons, dual braking systems, side view mirrors, and the padding and softening of interior surfaces and protrusions. For a moment, it appeared that safety advocates had gotten everything they'd sought for decades. There was just one problem. While the NHTSA could make automakers install seatbelts, it couldn't make anyone actually wear them. And few did. A report compiled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, showed that even in the mid-1980s, just 11% of automobile occupants were wearing seatbelts. The percentage was no doubt far lower for those of us who'd spent the previous 10 years riding around in the back seat, or in the station wagon's cargo bed, or up on the rear window ledge. Old habits were hard to break. By the late 1960s, most adults had spent their whole lives driving without seatbelts and weren't excited to start. Without grown-ups setting the example, few kids were likely to begin buckling up on their own. What's more, old myths persisted. Some people believed wearing seatbelts could inhibit their escape in the event their car became submerged or caught on fire, events they apparently deemed more likely than simply getting T-boned at an intersection. Others maintained it was actually safer to be thrown from a car in a crash, despite experts having proved decades before that the exact opposite was true. In time, the NHTSA concluded that if people weren't going to buckle up on their own, it had no choice but to force automakers to make cars do the job. By 1970, such technology was already in development. Both Volvo and Volkswagen, two foreign automakers, of course, had been working on creating automatic seatbelts for some time. The idea was to mechanize the process of strapping in the driver once he or she had sat down and closed the door or started the engine. Confident any wrinkles could be worked out in time, the NHTSA mandated that all vehicles manufactured in 1973 include automatic seatbelts or airbags, another device in development. Though automakers were able to delay the mandate from taking effect, many, including GM, grudgingly began offering automatic seatbelts as options. Automatic seatbelts were almost universally detested. Not only didn't the systems work well, the equipment could be downright dangerous. The most common system combined a manually buckled lap belt with a shoulder strap brought into position by an electronic runner traveling along a track built into the door frame. When the door was opened, the runner automatically raced back to its original position beside the dashboard to allow the occupant to exit. However, if the drivers impulsively reached down to, say, pick up a pair of dropped sunglasses before the system initiated, the strap would smack them in the face from the front. If drivers opened the door to check on their parking, the strap could wrap around their neck from behind. And if drivers didn't react fast enough to escape the confused system, the strap could wrap around their neck like a noose. It was, ironically, a safety device that could kill you. To defend its stance on automatic seatbelts, the Department of Transportation trotted out a study showing how cars equipped with the devices reduced highway fatalities as much as 67%. But the argument won over almost no one. People hated the newfangled claptrap. They didn't buy cars equipped with automatic belts, and evaded using the belts in cars that were. After all, most automatic seatbelt systems still required users to manually buckle their lap belt, and it wasn't difficult to simply duck one's head under the traveling shoulder strap. Also, there was little hope of making automatic seatbelt systems workable for backseat or middle passengers. Worn down by years of consumer opposition and lobbying efforts by the auto industry, the NHTSA finally gave up its effort to make automatic seatbelts mandatory in 1981. Even with the death of automatic seatbelts, the Battle of the Buckle wasn't over. The cavalry simply had yet to arrive. Once again, the charge would be led by the insurance industry, and in time a state-by-state effort was mounted to pass new laws. Americans may not have liked seatbelt laws, but they did grow to accept them, especially as one generation gave way to the next. One government study showed seatbelt use jumped from just 11% in 1981 to 68% in 1997. Over that same period, the number of automobile fatalities per million miles traveled was cut in half. While the decrease can't be attributed to seatbelt use alone, there is no question seatbelts played a primary role. Today, the NHTSA estimates seatbelt use runs as high as 85%. Our highways are safer too. In fact, they're the safest they've been since 1949. Despite significantly more motorists on our highway, just 32,719 people lost their lives in highway vehicle accidents in 2013. In 1979, the peak of my family's road tripping days, that figure was 51,093. For those of us who grew up traveling the highways unencumbered by seatbelts, the passage of mandatory state seatbelt laws was the passing of an era. Sure, we were all suddenly a lot safer on the highways. But that protection came at a price. Gone were the days of lying up on the rear window ledge, soaking in the warm sunshine. No longer would we be able to stretch out for a nap on the laps of our older siblings, or hoist our elbows up over the front seat to stare out at the road ahead over the shoulders of our parents. And our own children will never know the pleasure of clearing out a space amid the luggage in the back of the station wagon to enjoy a private lunch and wave at passing drivers. Those days are gone for good. Chapter 11. Up, up, and away. All roads lead to the airport. America is shrinking. It's a much smaller place today than it was in the 1970s, just as it was a much smaller country in the 1970s than it was in, say, the 1870s. Advancements in transportation will do that. The easier it becomes to travel from one end of the country to the other, the closer it all seems. Once upon a time, a trip to California might as well have been a voyage to Mars. You loaded up a Conestoga wagon with all your earthly possessions, kissed your loved ones goodbye, and set off into the great unknown. It was a journey fraught with peril to a destination about which you knew little, on an adventure from which you were unlikely to ever return, either because it required too much effort and expense, or because you'd die along the way. Today, the same trip means spending a few $100 for a plane ticket to visit places you've already seen 1,000 times in movies and on TV, and you'll be back in time for work on Monday. The greatest challenges you're likely to face are an overzealous Transportation Security Administration agent or being seated next to a colicky baby in coach. In the 70s, travel was still in many ways closer to the days of Lewis and Clark than the era of frequent flyer miles. America was still a country big enough to hold an almost limitless supply of unexpected delights, hidden dangers, and fascinating curiosities. On an extended road trip, you were certain to encounter a few of each. On one stretch of highway, you could discover the world's best roadside barbecue joint. Our favorite was Sammy's Pit Barbecue outside Jackson, Mississippi. On another, you might cross the border between two states by driving straight through a mountain, as you could do via the East River Mountain Tunnel connecting Virginia and West Virginia. And on another patch of highway, you might find yourself stranded at the side of the road with a steaming radiator, miles from anywhere, and years before the invention of the cell phone, hoping the driver who stopped to offer you a ride wasn't an escapee from a nearby lunatic asylum. But to have those experiences, you had to travel through the country, not over it. In those days, we didn't know nearly as much about our destinations, and we knew even less about what to expect once we arrived. At a time before cable TV and long before the internet, we had only a vague idea of what many distant locations even looked like. It wasn't hard to imagine the beaches of Florida, of course, and like everyone else who watched The Wonderful World of Disney every Sunday night, we had a good idea of what we'd find at Disney World. But when my family first arrived in New Orleans' French Quarter in 1976, we might as well have been the pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock. Coming as we had from the mundane Midwest, we were truly strangers in a strange land. The colorful stucco and elaborate wrought iron balconies of the buildings were unlike anything we'd seen before. We were awed by the grandeur of St. Louis Cathedral, entranced by the paddle wheel boat churning its way down the nearby Mississippi River, intrigued and slightly terrified by the sight of the crumbling above-ground burial vaults of St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. It seemed exotic and foreign. Today, these sites are familiar even to those who've never traveled to New Orleans, simply from spotting them in everything from movies and TV shows to commercials and cable news segments. Back then, you had to spend days driving across the country to see them. And that made the experience all the more worthwhile. My parents didn't see the fact that America was so big as an obstacle. They viewed it as a challenge. There were a lot of interesting places in the country to visit, and they were determined to take us to see them all, whether we wanted to or not, and just so long as there was quality golfing close by. Setting off in a family cruiser 2 or 3 times a year, we managed to tick the boxes on a long checklist of interesting American destinations. Miami, Daytona Beach, the Florida Space Coast, Disney World, Pensacola, Charleston, Savannah, Atlanta, St. Louis, the Ozark Mountains, Memphis, Gettysburg, and more. After falling in love with New Orleans, my parents purchased a small studio condominium at a nearby golf resort in Diamond Head, Mississippi. making that location a regular destination throughout our travel years. By the time 1980 rolled around, we'd already covered tens of thousands of miles. But things were about to change. As summer 1980 drew to a close, my parents began discussing possible trip destinations for our upcoming Christmas and Easter breaks. My dad had been enjoying a particularly good season of golf that summer, so it came as no surprise when it was decided that we'd be heading down to our tiny studio condo at Diamond Head again for the holidays. Now in his mid-50s, Dad knew his best playing days were behind him, and he wanted to ride a hot streak as long as he could. Nor was it a big surprise when, one autumn evening as we were all gathered around the dinner table, my parents announced our destination for spring break. Washington, D.C. Mom and Dad had been on a bit of a history kick. On one recent trip, they took us to Charleston, South Carolina, where we visited Fort Sumter and the USS Yorktown aircraft carrier turned floating World War II museum. On another trip, we toured the Gettysburg battlefield. It made sense that we'd finally embark for our nation's capital. But it was what came out of my father's mouth next that caused our jaws to drop. What would you kids think if we all flew to D.C. instead of driving? Fly? On an airplane? Like those machines with wings and pilots who, I had it on good authority from reliable sources, some of my fifth grade buddies, invited kids up to the cockpit to fly the plane? And pretty stewardesses who came around and brought as many Cokes as you wanted? And tiny bathrooms in the rear that, after you flushed, dropped your pee from the sky on whoever was below? Again, my sources were quite clear on this. We were stunned, speechless. Was this another of Dad's lame jokes? My father certainly wasn't above pulling our legs on occasion, so my siblings and I kept looking at each other, waiting for the inevitable punchline to drop. Instead, Dad launched into an explanation, one he and my mom had obviously discussed. Listen, we only have 8 days for the trip, and there's so much for us to see in D.C. The White House, the Capitol Building, the Washington Monument, the Smithsonian Museums. We've read that each of those can take a day in itself. If we fly instead of drive, we'll have 2 extra days to cover as much as we can. So we were going to fly to save travel time? Seriously? Had my father suddenly won the lottery without us knowing? But he was too cheap to even buy a ticket. Had aliens abducted our father and replaced him with some pod person? Besides, how would we get around once we got there? Was our car coming on the plane, too? We'll get a cab from the airport to our hotel, my father continued. Then we'll just take the subway. They call it the Metro in D.C. Wherever we need to go. Almost everything is easy walking distance from a metro stop. We really don't even need a car. Wait. So in addition to my first flight on an airplane, I was also going to get out of this my first ride in a taxi cab? And my first ride on some sort of subway train type thing? All before I'd even entered the 6th grade? Count me in. Before Dad could even finish his pitch, my siblings and I were sold. Of course, in reality, the decision had already been made. My dad wasn't seeking our approval. He was just telling us what was going to happen to get us excited about our first family plane trip. The way he'd explained it, it all made perfect sense. And yet, none at all. If flying to our destination was such a smart choice now, why hadn't it been before? It sure would have been nice to have had a couple extra days at Disney World a few years back. Heck, I might have even had time to work up the courage to ride the Space Mountain roller coaster. It wasn't like we'd needed a car at Disney World either. They had buses and trams and even a monorail to shuttle us wherever we wanted to go. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized many of my friends also suddenly seemed to be flying with their families to distant destinations. Had something changed about flying I didn't know about? Was there a reason families like mine were suddenly leaving behind their station wagons to go jetting off to their vacation destinations? As it turned out, there was. I was simply too young to know it. It wasn't an empty gas tank or steaming radiator that would bring the era of family road trips sputtering to the shoulder. It was a pen. The one President Jimmy Carter used to sign the Airline Deregulation Act into law on October 1978. With a few sweeps of his hand, Carter almost instantly eliminated the barrier that for decades had prevented most middle-class families like mine from flying, and instead had us stuffing ourselves into station wagons, or in the case of my family, loading up our Lincolns, for long road trips. Deregulation unwound decades of government rules and red tape that had ensnared the airline industry and prevented the free market from working properly. Almost overnight, the cost of flying fell within reach of average American families. According to a report by the Government Accountability Office, the average airfare declined by around 30% between 1976 and 1990. Airfares to the most popular destinations dropped even more dramatically, and much sooner. When flying suddenly became more affordable, more people clamored to get on board. A lot more. In 1979, the first year following deregulation, 317 million passengers boarded U.S. flights, an increase of more than 50% from just 5 years earlier. The bulk of those additional passengers were people who'd never flown before because it had cost too much. Once strictly the domain of the wealthy and well-heeled, air travel was suddenly open to just about everyone. In one fell swoop, deregulation had democratized the skies. As Time declared on the cover of its August 14, 1978 issue, it was a new era in the air. No wonder so many families, even my own, were suddenly rethinking road travel by the early 80s. Given the obvious benefits of airline deregulation, why did it take so long? Why were we still heading out on the highways to drive to distant destinations in the 70s at all? To learn the answer, we need to take a short flight back to the beginnings of American aviation and learn why the industry became so regulated in the first place. As with automobiles, aviation in the United States was pioneered by men whose ambitions often exceeded the limits of good sense. Many of the first pilots had more screws loose than their machines. In hopes of securing lasting fame, or just the satisfaction of outdoing rivals, some sky jockeys would attempt just about any feat, no matter how daunting or how long the odds of success. Pilots continually vied to be the first to fly vast distances across treacherous seas or scorching deserts to exotic destinations. They attempted thrilling stunts, such as flying through the opened doors of barns, giving us the term barnstorming, to draw crowds and grab headlines. And often they refused to postpone scheduled flights due to threatening weather merely to prove their manliness. Such daring exploits went a long way in capturing the public's fascination with flying, and ultimately led to Charles Lindbergh's historic crossing of the Atlantic in 1927. But this reckless ambition also resulted in scores of deadly crashes and did little to instill confidence that aviation was a safe and reliable means of transportation. By the 1920s, several domestic airlines had been established to carry passengers between select destinations. But if the industry was to grow, aviation leaders realized they needed the government's help to build new infrastructure, airports, landing strips, navigational aids, and to establish the safety standards and basic rules of the road, or in this case, the air. At the urging of these leaders, Congress established the Aeronautic Branch of the Department of Commerce to ensure civil air safety. The department's purview included testing and licensing pilots, inspecting and certifying aircraft, writing and enforcing safety rules, designating airways, operating and maintaining navigational aids, and investigating aviation accidents. With some basic parameters and policies for the aviation industry set, the job seemed done. Except, of course, it wasn't. In fact, the government was just getting started. As bureaucracies tend to view such matters, if a few good rules are sufficient, then many more are even better. The aviation industry also became swept up in a wave of sentiment opposing free market competition in the 1930s. The prevailing concern was that unfettered competition could drive down profits to the point that no individual business could survive operating safely and responsibly. As a result, the federal government vastly expanded the regulation of industries it deemed of vital national importance: banking, trucking, railroads, and eventually aviation. Conspicuous in its absence from this list was the auto industry. As the employer of tens of thousands of American workers and the producer of the country's primary means of transportation, the auto industry would seem to have been one of vital national interest and therefore a target for regulation. That the industry wasn't deemed vital by Congress speaks to the power the industry already wielded in defending its interests by the 1930s. Is it really any wonder federal involvement in automobile safety standards remained decades away? Not only was commercial air travel beginning to flourish, but the transportation of soldiers and military supplies by air was increasingly viewed as essential for national defense. So Congress established the Civil Aeronautics Board, CAB, in 1938. From that moment on, individual airlines no longer had the power to set their own fares, routes, and schedules. Instead, these were all determined by a committee of bureaucrats in Washington. For decades, the airlines essentially operated on, well, autopilot. The CAB assigned each airline a specific service area, dictated the routes it could fly, and determined the fares it could charge and the amount of profit it could earn. Airlines were even told the models of aircraft they could operate and how they were to configure their seats on each plane. All that remained for the airlines to do was offer passengers a choice of coffee, tea, or milk. By and large, the big airlines weren't unhappy with the arrangement. After all, they didn't have to worry about things like streamlining their operations to keep airfares competitive. Ticket prices were set for them. What's more, the number of flights between cities was limited, and competition restricted, all but ensuring that planes were filled with passengers. Profits were virtually guaranteed. The folks boarding flights, though, were hardly average Americans. Only the very wealthy, or business travelers with expense accounts allowing them to act as such, could afford tickets. To please airline investors and employee unions, the CAB kept airfares high to keep profits high. According to the Air Transport Association, the cost of a round-trip coach ticket between New York and Los Angeles in 1958 was $208, around $1,600 in today's dollars. Such inflated fares typically included gourmet meals with silverware, white glove service, and loads of legroom, prompting some today to recall the era as a lost golden age of flight. But it was a golden age only for those who had the gold. Small wonder that ordinary Americans of the 1950s and early 1960s, especially families, took to crossing the country by car, while society's upper crust streaked overhead in gleaming silver planes. It wasn't until the early 1960s that the highly regulated airline system began to encounter turbulence. Ironically, the cause was the arrival of an advancement hailed as the next great leap in commercial aviation, the jet airliner. Jets were faster, safer, and far more efficient than the piston engine planes they quickly replaced. In fact, jet aircraft may have been too efficient. Because commercial jets were able to carry more passengers farther and faster than ever before, airlines soon found themselves with lots of empty seats. They were also prohibited from dropping their fares to attract new customers who could buy up the extra capacity. At the same time, the number of travelers who could afford to fly remained unchanged. As a result, many planes began flying less than half filled. With profits in a tailspin by the 1970s, management at the major airlines took what little action it could. Unable to compete on price, airlines found other ways to fight over customers. They secured approval to spread out seating for additional legroom. After all, they had nothing if not extra space. They served up steaks and gourmet fare. They created the first frequent flyer programs to inspire loyalty. They hired the most attractive young women they could find as stewardesses and dressed them in miniskirts and go-go boots. In one famous ad campaign, National Airlines featured beguiling female attendants inviting prospective, and presumably male, passengers to fly me. However, it did little to boost sagging revenues. As it did to American travel in general, OPEC's 1973 oil embargo and the economic turmoil that followed dealt other staggering blows to the airline industry. Unsure of what the future held, many people, even the wealthy, put vacations on hold. Making matters worse, corporations slashed travel budgets, significantly reducing the number of business travelers, the airline's most important customers. The airlines were locked on a course for disaster. Because of strict regulation, carriers couldn't reduce fares to fill their empty seats. They couldn't abandon unprofitable routes. They couldn't even open new routes that showed the potential to turn a profit. Though it was possible to file an application to open a new route, the approval process was so slow and complex, it was virtually useless to try. In one notorious example, World Airways applied to the CAB for permission to open a new route between New York and Los Angeles in 1967. Finally, years later, the application was returned to the airline with a letter of rejection noting, "This application is 6.5 years out of date. It is no longer current or relevant." Meanwhile, in contrast to the big national carriers, one airline wasn't only surviving but thriving. Its secret? Being small enough to fly through a loophole in all of the regulatory red tape. In the mid-1960s, as it was becoming clear that regulation was strangling U.S. airlines, it occurred to an attorney named Herb Kelleher that federal controls applied only to airlines that crossed over state lines, not airlines that flew only within them. Without having to submit to the ill-conceived dictates of Washington bureaucracy, Kelleher reasoned, an airline flying within a single state could offer airfares at a fraction of the prices that the national carriers charged. What's more, Kelleher happened to live in a state big enough for such an idea to make sense, Texas. The second largest state in the nation, behind only Alaska, Texas is distinguished by having numerous bustling cities located hundreds of miles apart, an arrangement ideally suited for an airline formed to operate solely within the borders of a single state. So in 1967, Kelleher and a partner, Rollin King, founded Air Southwest Co., the carrier we know today as Southwest Airlines. The idea of an intrastate airline wasn't new. Many small airlines around the country flew point-to-point routes within a single state, evading federal regulations. But nearly all were one- or two-plane operations, connecting commuters in major cities to unique destinations, such as islands or specific tourist attractions. Southwest Airlines aimed to operate on a much larger scale, beginning with a small fleet of Boeing 737s flying dozens of daily routes between Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. In developing Southwest Airlines and its edgy personality, Herb Kelleher borrowed heavily from the ideas of another interstate carrier, Pacific Southwest Airlines, PSA, which had operated in California since 1949. Besides offering similarly discounted airfares as PSA, Southwest also copied the airline's hiring strategy. To select Southwest's all-female staff of flight attendants, Kelleher appointed a committee headed by a man who'd handpicked the hostesses for Hugh Hefner's Playboy jet. The selected candidates included outgoing and attractive former dancers, majorettes, and cheerleaders, whom Southwest dressed in shape-hugging uniforms featuring short skirts. Kelleher even appropriated PSA's risque tagline for his advertising, "Long legs and short nights." Today, it's hard to imagine an airline with such a campaign not suffering the wrath of Twitter. For its part, PSA openly welcomed the addition of another upstart interstate airline as a rebel ally in its revolt against federal regulations, the airline invited Kelleher to tour its facilities, assisted in training Southwest's mechanics, and loaned it startup manuals and other necessities. The combination of cheap airfares and friendly service was an instant hit with Texans. While the national airlines battled over a